welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn and this is episode 196 of the podcast, and it is 22nd of September 2014 as I record this, a little early for the weekend show, but I'm getting my ducks in a row because I have a book launch this week. So today I have an interview with thriller author Simon Toyne, whose Sanctus trilogy have been worldwide bestsellers, and he is a bit of a superstar here in the UK, and I was super excited to chat with him, and you'll hear the faint hero worship in my voice, I'm pretty sure. And he also writes religious thrillers, so of course, since that's my kind of genre too, I really was thrilled to talk with him, and he's very funny too, so we had a great chat. And we talk about the inspirations for the book, and I also grill him on how his first book managed to do so well, because he basically quit his job, wrote a book, and it became a massive worldwide bestseller. He talks about how his 20 years of experience in commercial television helped him craft the story. And like Lee Child, he came from UK commercial TV, which clearly we all need to learn screenwriting story techniques. So anyway, I think you'll find it interesting. So my news, big launch this week, Business for Authors, How to Be an Author Entrepreneur, is now available. As you listen to this, it is available. And thanks to pre-orders, the new pre-order availability on Amazon, I've got a simultaneous release. So I've got ebooks on all platforms at the same time, ready on launch day, plus a print book, plus my audiobook, all available right now. You can get all the links at thecreativepen.com/businessbook. You can also buy it direct from me. It's funny because I've never actually done this. I've never had print, ebooks on all platforms and audio available on the same day. So it's quite exciting, really. And of course, I've had the pre-orders going for a while now. I also recorded the audiobook myself. So if you'd like more of my dulcet tones, if you can't get enough of me talking, if you go to thecreativepen.com/business audio, you will find the audiobook. And that is 6 hours of MP3 recordings with me narrating the book, and also a little extras throughout as I read a chapter and then kind of add in a bit more. So I'm not sure what that's called, whether that's unabridged or whatever that is, but yeah. And if you've already bought the ebook or the print book, there's a voucher code, so you can get the same price discount off the audiobook. So if you want to check out the written word first and then you decide to upgrade, you can get that discount. So I'm very excited about the book, as it's definitely very useful for authors, and it's helped me to write it, and I hope you find it helpful for your business, or if you're just sort of transitioning into taking this seriously, then you might find it useful. And for more audio fun, if you want more audiobooks, my thriller Day of the Vikings is available now. It's actually probably my most popular book. It's just such a laugh and great adventure. And my narrator, Veronica Jaguer, actually did an amazing job of the Norse that I use in the book, because there's a few, I have a character in there, Blake Daniel, who's a psychic, and alongside Morgan Sierra from my Arcane series, it sort of blends the two characters. And basically the story set in the British Museum, opens in the British Museum as Neo-Vikings storm the place to take this staff of power, and there's a lot of fun, but I use a lot of Norse in using the prose Edda, which is a poem, and I say a poem, the poetic Edda, and essentially Veronica reads it really well, and when I sent it to her originally, I said, I'm really sorry about this. But she did a great job. And I love listening to it, actually. It's lovely. So if you like audio, check out Day of the Vikings on Amazon, Audible, or iTunes. If you review audiobooks, I have some promo codes, so you can email me, joanna@thecreativepen.com, and I will send you a promo code if you can leave a review. So that would be awesome. Other news? I was talking about Vikings. I was in Stockholm last weekend, speaking at several events for authors and entrepreneurs, and I wrote a long blog post about it. But basically, I was really inspired to be talking to a group of authors who just don't have any of the advantages we have right now. And we take this for granted. I know there's probably some people listening who are not in America or Britain or Australia or some of the other countries where we've got, we can pretty much do anything now, and that's amazing. And the self-publishing revolution is really only just starting. And I spoke to an artist who was there, like a sculptor, and she was saying how similar this kind of change is to the way that artists work. I also went to a modern dance event this week, called Inala in London, which is like Zulu modern ballet with Ladysmith Black Mambazo singing. And I was looking at the way dancers work and the collaboration between these professionals, and just, the way that creatives are collaborating together and, doing our own thing. So I'm just super excited about what the next few years hold in terms of creativity, collaboration with others. I had a pretty amazing week last week because also on Friday, oh, I also spoke at the IPG, the Independent Publishers Guild, something, group. And what was crazy, I spoke to them about some of the things I do as an indie author, and they were just gobsmacked. A lot of them didn't understand, even basic things about the stuff that we do. And I felt really happy that I'm not with a publisher. But also on Friday, I spoke at the launch of One Fred's Place, One Frederick's Place in London, which is this amazing city. I'm obviously tired. I had a really big week. No, this awesome space in the city of London. So it's right near the Bank of England. And it's three floors, four floors, and there's this place called Fab Lab on the ground floor, which is a place to go and prototype things and play with 3D printing and laser cutters and make physical stuff. So it's essentially, if you come up with an idea, you can go there and use all the tools and make things and then put your prototype on Kickstarter or whatever. And then the next floor up is Bathtub to Boardroom, which is this incubator for startups. And then the next floor is Escape the City, which is where I was working, which is education for people who want to leave their corporate jobs. And I gave a talk on creative entrepreneurship. And next week, I'm speaking on making a living from your writing. And I'm speaking there pretty much. I'll be doing some regular stuff there, I expect. But I was just so excited to be at this launch of this creative space and very excited to go and play in the Fab Lab, actually, because I'm excited about 3D printing as well. I just feel this real movement out of corporate and into creativity. We live in super exciting times, people. Yeah. Anyway, I think this is why I'm so tired. I've just been like excited every day for about 8 days, and my introvert brain is exploding. Even more exciting, actually, is this weekend. I'm going to the London Tattoo Convention, which again is full of amazingly creative artists. And my opinion on tattoos have really changed since I started writing my London Psychic series, and I will not be getting a tattoo this weekend, but I will be doing a lot of research for the third in the London Psychic series, which will be called Deviance, and I'm excited about that. So much going on, actually. Yeah, so much going on, and I hope your life is just as exciting as mine. I am so thankful every day right now about the opportunities that we have if we just reach out and take them. Okay, if you want to hear me speak, and I seem to be more and more of an international speaker these days, I will be in Frankfurt Book Fair in 2 weeks' time, and in London quite regularly now, you can go to thecreativepen.com/speaking and find that. I will definitely be in Charleston for PubSmart next March, so that's exciting too. I'll let you know when that launches if you're in America. Okay, after all that intro, the podcast is sponsored by fantastic Kobo Writing Life, and their support pays for the hosting for the show. And my time in producing the show is sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to the people supporting on Patreon, patreon.com. And a shout out to my new supporters this week, Lisa Barrick, Joni Newtonen, I think it's Newton, and sorry, Joni, if I've massacred that. Joni is Finnish. And Selena Shapland and Ellie Ash. Thank you to you guys. And you can support the show at patreon.com/thecreativepen. Or, of course, you can buy my books. Okay, here's a little word from Kobo Writing Life, and then I'll get straight into the interview with Simon Toyne.
Hi, Creative Pen listeners. This is Mark LaFave, Director of Self-Publishing and Author Relations for Kobo. What is Kobo? Kobo is a global e-book company. Born out of Canada, Kobo is available in 190 countries around the world. Now, authors like Joanna Penn already are taking full advantage of the fact that while there may be certain players, world's longest river, that exist and are quite prominent in a few nations, Kobo is available and continuing to expand and grow in territories around the world. And one of the wonderful things about being a Kobo Writing Life author is when you look at that dashboard and you see that you sold a book in some country that you probably haven't heard of before. Check us out at KoboWritingLife.com. And now back to your host, Joanna Penn.
Hi everyone, I'm thriller author J.F. Penn, and today I'm here with Simon Toyne. Hi Simon.
Hello.
Hello, and just a little introduction. Simon is the best-selling author of the Sanctus trilogy, translated into 28 languages and published in 50 countries. The first book was the UK's biggest-selling debut thriller of 2011, and all three books in the Sanctus trilogy were Sunday Times bestsellers in hardback and paperback. And I love the Sanctus book, so I'm so excited to have Simon on the show.
That's very kind of you to say so. No money changed hands for that kind of those kind words.
So I'm obviously a sucker for anything with a religious title or a broad brush cross on the front of a book, so I jumped on your books. But for people who haven't read the trilogy, can you kind of give us some broad brush story strokes?
That's always the killer question, isn't it? Because you're sort of reducing like 1,500 pages worth into a kind of catchy thing that goes, make by this book, and doesn't, you know, make it sound really derivative and sucky. At the heart of it is, it's the fundamental idea that kind of kicked the whole thing off and grew into this trilogy was a notion that, what if in the past, right at the beginning of history, right at the beginning of the time, when history took a right turn, what if, what happened to the people who were left behind who kind of stayed on the left path, effectively? It's a modern thriller, and it's very much, it's about identity, really. It's about the identity of the West, of Christianity and religion, Western religions in particular, organized religions, how they grew. But the mirroring that, the human story is this sense of identity of my main character, who's a female journalist who has got identity issues of her own and gets kind of sucked into this huge mystery and this huge dangerous conspiracy. And actually what she's really trying to do, what drives her, is not that she's trying to uncover some, you know, big faceless plot, is she's trying to find out who she is. So that was the heart of it for me. It's this kind of story about identity. And it's got, you know, dangerous sects and killers, sects, and it's, I should have not clarified that, I've probably got more readers, and it's got it's kind of, it's quite a techno thriller as well. There's lots of technology in it. The third one, the tower, has got the Hubble Space Telescope, and it mirrors the Tower of Babel in that the telescope is looking to the furthest reaches of the universe and trying to gaze upon the face of God, which some people think is a heresy. And so I kind of tried to take all of those, the kind of the foundations of Western religion, particularly Christianity, mirror them in individuals' lives in the present and our own situation, and pose the big what if of what if what we thought about religion and the origin of it was all a bit wrong.
What if, indeed.
What if, the big weird, the starting point, the seed that, from which all of these huge narrative trees grow.
Yeah, no, and it's great. And now what's kind of striking, even if people just download a sample, I think the beginning part is really striking, because there's a monk who commits suicide off the top of this citadel of ruin. And I think ruin itself is almost a character. Maybe you could talk about ruin and your inspiration for the place.
Well, ruin is where a lot of it takes part, and ruin is the oldest continually inhabited city in the world, and it's situated in ancient Anatolia, well, ancient Mesopotamia, so the Fertile Crescent, the land between two rivers, and those two rivers being two of the rivers that flowed out of the Garden of Eden, so that's how old it is, which is now modern-day Turkey. And the thing was, I didn't want to say where ruin was. I kind of wanted to kind of leave it vague. But like a character, the more I got into it and the more I had to sort of work out the history of it and the mythology of it and all this sort of stuff, I realized I couldn't sort of, I had to say where it was. And Turkey was the best place because it's seen this huge amount of history kind of swishing through it, and it's right on the edge of Asia and Europe and the Middle East and the biblical land, so it's perfectly situated. And it's amazing history there. You know, Troy is there, and Ephesus, exactly. I mean, it's like so much history. There's so much forgotten history that kind of predates what we think of as ancient history, which is generally Greek and Roman. It's like way beyond that. And even in Egypt, you know, there were civilizations there before that. So it was the perfect place to set it. And I realized that I couldn't, and I genuinely looked around for a real place that I could sort of, you know, add a few bits to and plonk this citadel, this carved mountain monastery in the middle of. And because there isn't a place. And I just thought, I just couldn't take such liberties with a real place. So in the end, I just invented this place. Because no real place suited the story, and the place had to be is intrinsic to the story and does have this character, because it's this place that has effectively the legend is that there's this sacrament, this sacred relic that is kept in this monastery, which is carved out of this vertical mountain in the middle of this town, which has grown up around it, that has supposedly got some sort of divine power and was the foundation upon which ultimately Christianity and lots of the Abrahamic religions were built. And no one's seen it, because no one ever, people go into the mountain, only men, patriarchal proper monastery, and no one ever comes out. And that's how they've kept a secret of whether what this thing is and whether it even exists. And so I liked this idea that you've got this effectively, this almost medieval monastery surrounded by kind of Disneyland almost, you know, because this huge industry has grown up of the sacrament and what's the sacrament and whatever, and people just go there. It's a bit like Lourdes or Santiago de Compostela, all these kind of places where these kind of shrine places which have become industry, or the Vatican is another one, you know, these huge industries have grown up and tourists go there, this kind of religious, say, this spiritual tourism. And so that's where it came from. And it was a slow process of building it, you know, because I had to kind of build it from the ground up and think about the history, and a lot of it's borrowed. I mean, interestingly, the main character, who's American, she flies in, and she flies to a city called Gaziantep, which exists and is indeed one of the oldest continually inhabited cities in the world. And so she flies in there and gets on a cab and then drives up into the foothills of the Taurus Mountains to ruin. So that journey from Gaziantep up into the foothills is where she sort of goes off the map. Because Gaziantep is real. New York, New Jersey, a lot of it takes place there, is all real. And so it's only when they go up to ruin that it sort of slightly goes into the crease of a map, as I describe it.
Yeah. And I mean, you take a lot of these ideas from places around the world. Did you do a lot of travel for your research, or are you a travel junkie like I am?
I did some travel for this, but it wasn't specifically for this, although it turned out that way. Before I was a full-time novelist, I worked for nearly 20 years in television. And when I was cutting my teeth as a director, there were just every other program on television seemed to be a travel program or a holiday program. So I made a lot of those, and I traveled everywhere, making these little kind of holiday programs, travel adventure programs. And it's amazing how much of that I have drawn on and continue to draw on when I'm writing. I sort of need a place, and I think of somewhere I've been, and with Google Maps now, you can go back there from your desk and whatever, but there's loads of stuff, and I go back to old photographs of me looking, ridiculously young and thin and not great at all, or wrinkly, and go back there, and it's really, you're constantly the good thing about writer is it makes you reanalyze the stuff that you've done and think about them and make sense of them and revisit these places. It gives you an excuse to sort of navel gaze a bit, but with a purpose. So I did a lot of travel, but then the story about the travel that specifically feeds into Sanctus and Ruin, the city of Ruin, is that I, having worked for nearly 20 years in television, I was getting a tiny bit jaded. I was just ending up making the same programs that I'd made several times before. And I'd always wanted to write a book. I'd always, from, my 18-year-old self staring out at the vast vista of my life ahead, said, yep, definitely going to be a novel in there somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I was approaching 40 and was like, where's the novel? Where's the novel then? My 18-year-old self was tapping me on the shoulder and going, yeah, you really let me down on the novel front. And with a full-time career and a young family and everything, it's really hard to find the time to. You can't just knock off a novel. It's like saying, I'm just going to pop out and run a marathon. It's like, you need to prepare, you need to do it. It takes time. It takes a lot out of you. And I thought I couldn't, the job working in television was very creatively exhausting. I won't say it was demanding necessarily, but it was quite creatively exhausting. And I didn't want to do that thing of, sort of carving out a bit of a weekend and going, now I'm tired and I've had a hell of a week, but now the novel, and sort of just do it firing on, two cylinders. So I kind of took the decision, maybe it was a midlife crisis, possibly, to just take some time off. So I quit my job and took 6 months off. And rather than sit in my spare room depressingly sort of in my pants trying to write a novel, people going, how's Simon doing with the novel with me with a kind of big beard? My eldest was not quite in school yet, so we said, well, why don't we just go somewhere? Let's go somewhere for 6 months and have an adventure. And part of it was me thinking, if I fail at writing the book, I can always then describe this time as that time we spent in France, as it turned out, rather than that time I failed to write a book. So I was kind of future-proofing my own failure. And so that's what we did. We rented our place out in Brighton, where we live in England, and rented a place in this middle of the countryside in the south of France in December, in the winter, because it's cheaper, and spent 6 months here. And I wrote the first about 180 pages of a book that was then called Ruin and then came to be known as Sanctus a year and a half later when I finally finished it after going back to work and having to do the weekend thing and all that stuff that I was trying to avoid.
Yeah, it's quite a story. And I'm interested because you use a combination of Christian ideas and pagan myths and historical stuff in the book. How do you feel you walk the line between kind of orthodox religion and people who like kind of Christian books, let's say, with a spiritual side of things? How do you think you've managed that line that Dan Brown kind of failed?
you've got the kind of Dan Brown fatwa on you now by saying such a thing. It was really weird because when I came out to France to write my book, I had two or three ideas that I'd been kicking around in my head. The answer is I never set out to write a Christian book or a religious book. That was as far away from what I was intending to write as possible. So I had these two or three ideas, which were very, because I worked in commercial television, so I kind of knew I could write. I knew I'd spent 20 years writing scripts and stuff, so I knew I could kind of be creative on demand. I produced something, the quality of which was debatable and up for grabs, but I knew I could produce something. And I figured that what I should do is I should write something that was close to my own experience, because I wouldn't have to research it. And so I thought, modern, contemporary guy, a bit like me, thrown into extraordinary circumstances, very Hitchcock, very Harlan Coben, that kind of thing. And I thought, that's what I need to do. Then I don't have to research anything. And in 6 months, I can probably get a rough draft down of what the story is and, you know, sort of work on characters and all that sort of stuff. Because the other thing I was aware of is, like, I'd spent all this time writing scripts, but when you write scripts, you never describe anything. Mm. You never have to, because the camera, you point the camera and there it is. And so, you know, it was a big new area of writing that I needed to sort of develop quickly. And so, again, like, let's set it in the modern era, because you can just look at it and describe it. You don't have to research, all that sort of stuff. So all of these reasons. So I had these two or three ideas. And it was only when we were driving to France in December, because it was cheap, at the start of our adventure, and I was in a van full of a bunch of stuff, mostly soft toys, to make our rented house in France look homely for when the children arrived a couple of days later. So it was like, here's your new home, and here's your stuff, so it's home, kind of thing. We set sail on the midnight ferry, and we were going to drive. It's a day's drive to get to where we are in France. It's way in the south, near Toulouse. And being 1st of December, we went from New Haven to Dieppe, and this huge storm just blew up in the channel, and we didn't get any sleep, because we caught the midnight ferry because we were going to sleep and then drive through the night and the day to get there. And we had no sleep at all, so we just arrived in, you know, thankfully in France alive, and needed to go and find a hotel somewhere. So we drove an hour inland, and an hour inland from Dieppe is Rouen. And as we were coming in, the storm had blown out and dawn was starting to kind of lighten the sky. And I saw the silhouette of Rouen Cathedral up on the hill. And it's a very weird cathedral, Rouen Cathedral. It's got this kind of like hypodermic syringe of a needle of a spire that sort of pierces the sky. And these kind of bits, it's very gothic and weird. It's almost like a spider. It's a strange thing. And when I saw it, this quote just popped into my head that I'd read years ago and always liked and kind of always wondered, you know, and kind of carried around with me in that sort of way, like picking up a shiny thing and putting it in your pocket. And the quote is the one that's at the beginning of Sanctus, which is the Ralph Waldo Emerson quote, which is, a man is a god in ruins. And there was something about that quote and the image of the cathedral and the play on words of Rouen, ruin, that just planted the seed. And then we went and slept in a hotel for a few hours and got up and then carried on driving. And the radio in this old van that we'd got broke. So I was, for 8 hours, I was on my own with my thought, with just this idea kind of whirring around in my head. And by the time we got to the house, it had just taken root. And of course, it was nothing like the things I was going to write. It required a huge amount of research. In the end, it required a huge amount of building a whole town from city from scratch, history and all, and legends and mythology and all. But it was the best idea. It was totally the best idea I had. Mm. I just knew it was the best idea. And so these other ideas that I've still never written just fell by the wayside, and I just started writing this thing. And so I think because it kind of came out of this idea of just recognizing a good story, it wasn't like I went, oh, Dan Brown sold lots of books, I'll do one of those, or anything. And I mean, if anything, more of an influence is Name of the Rose, which was written 23 years before Da Vinci Code. You know, people, and it, because, you know, Da Vinci Code was large in everyone's sights when Sanctus was coming out. Everyone was like, oh, is this, did you read the Da Vinci Code and whatever? And in actual fact, I only read the Da Vinci Code about halfway through writing Sanctus, and I suddenly panicked and thought, what if I'm actually writing the same story?
Which it's nothing like it, actually.
No, I know, but you just, but then, you know, I kind of picked it up, and I, page one, there's a monk, and I'm like, oh, great, there we go. It's just like, you know, 9 months of work, just throw it. And then, of course, page two, I'm like, no, that's, yeah. And by the time, page four or five, I was like, yeah, no, it's totally different, it's fine. But the other thing is, you know, all the ideas in it come out of the story. It's not like I have kind of a checklist of like, oh, I like this stuff, so I'm going to write something about this. I had the idea. I had the end. What I came up with almost first was the end of the first book, and I didn't set out to write a trilogy. It was, you know, I had no deal or agent or anything. It was just, let's try and write the best book I can, which is why I picked this ridiculously hard idea in the end. And so I worked backwards from that. Of like, well, if this is the big secret, you know, and the engine of Sanctus is, what is the sacrament? Does it exist, and what is it? And because it's a patriarchal, secretive monastery, and that only men have ever been allowed to go in, of course, you know, as a writer, what you want to do is make things really hard for your protagonist. So who's the best person? Who's the most unlikely person to discover that secret? A woman. So I worked backwards, and so my main character became a woman. You know, and again, people are like, oh, did you write a strong female character because there's a gap in the market because there aren't that many of them? It's like, no, I didn't. I wasn't that smart and kind of, yeah, this is good. This is really, yeah. It's like I had a meeting with my people and went, okay, here's the pie chart of what people are reading, and I think there's a gap here. Should we do this? Should we do this? Women, who hands up for a woman? You know, everything grew organically out of the story, including the religious stuff, because the whole point of the idea is that this mystical relic, even though it's kind of been co-opted by Christianity, it predates it, and kind of Christianity grew out of it. And I have this the cross that suckered you into buying it, which was on the cover, which is the Tau, which is the T-shaped cross, favoured by the new Pope, in fact, going back to Francis of Assisi, which predates the Latin cross. And actually, when you read about it, it would have been the cross that they would have crucified Christ on, because the Romans were, you know, what do we know about the Romans? They were very efficient. And building one of those, a carpenter building something like that, these mortise joints, it's complicated carpentry. And they were crucifying a lot of people. So they was like, what's an easier one? Something like that with a cross thing on it, balanced.
Stick
with
on
a little,
the top, yeah.
Really easy. So that is the cross. So the Christian cross should look like that. It shouldn't look like that. And so you sort of have all these things and you kind of go, oh, that's interesting. And so let's just kind of go and play with these myths and these kind of preconceptions and go back and take a symbol that predated it and, you know, was very much kind of seen as, you know, it's in Egyptian spiritual, the kind of canon, and it goes back beyond that. It's a pagan symbol as well. It's like, So that's where it came from, and if I blend it together well, it's just because I think it's because it's all serving story. It's not the other way around. It's not like here's all this stuff. How can I kind of cobble a story together or bolt it to it? And it's just, and actually, you know, religion or theology as a subject that I know you're very familiar with is really about, it's about ideas. It's about ideas to do with belief and God and all this sort of gods. Plural, and it's endlessly fascinating because they're mystical mirrors that reflect our own situation, all of them, and so that's I think why we're endlessly fascinated by it. And it's there, and actually, if you really sort of drill down to it, they're just full of brilliant stories.
Yeah,
brilliant stories, the most amazing, brilliant stories.
Yeah,
and so that's, you know, as a writer, it's just as an endless. It's like a bottomless pit. It's like a well that will never run dry. It's like there's always something in there. There's always something interesting, and there's always another take to put on it. I mean, the hardest thing I think is doing the modern thriller thing against that and making that work without having to have, you know, that the history lesson bit where the expert goes, let me tell you about this thing that you don't know about, because otherwise the plot won't work. You know,
it's like
exposition. Yeah, it's really the hard thing. Yeah, where the expert explains stuff to the idiot.
Yeah. And so what are you writing next? What's your plan next?
Well, I've just finished the first draft of the new book. I'm doing second draft now, so I'm kind of going into that, which is a new series character. So it's similar territory, and it's about a man who doesn't know who he is and is on an epic journey of redemption. And kind of it's kind of mystical, but also it's modern again, and he has to kind of travel to various places, to go to various dangerous places. All of these places have secrets, and kind of find the secret and fix something. And in each place, he learns a bit about himself. It's very roughly based on the Ten Commandments. So it might be 10 books, with each one very loosely themed on one of the commandments. And he has to sort of, you know, go and kind of redress the balance of these kind of holy laws that have been put out of kilter. But largely, it's a thriller. It's a modern thriller. It's kind of, they're more like westerns, I think. I mean, this first one's set in Arizona, but the second one might be set on a boat, and the third one might be set in France.
Arizona. I love Arizona.
Arizona's great.
Yeah,
I did.
Storms.
I went. Arizona is amazing, isn't it?
It's like, I love it. I live there. I reckon I could live there in the red Sedona kind of deserty bit.
It's beautiful and weird and alien, and it's like being on a different planet. I have very Celtic skin, and so I'm like a vampire. So I don't think I could cope with the heat there, because it is ridiculously hot. They close everything in the summer because it's too hot. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, their summer is the winter because it's bearably hot rather than ridiculously, stupidly, you know, life-threateningly hot.
Yeah. No, that's cool. I'm going to look forward to those novels. Now, I want to just ask about your writing because you and Lee Child, I think, are the famous ones for giving up your jobs in TV screenwriting and becoming novelists. Although there are quite a few others who come out of screenwriting. So I wondered, like, what are the storytelling techniques that you learned through being a TV writer?
Well, Lee and I both worked in commercial British television, actually. We weren't necessarily script writers. We were producers, I suppose. I mean, he worked for Granada and I kind of worked for BBC and all over the place. And the thing is, if you're making commercial television, what you have to do is constantly hook the reader. You have to hook them with an interesting story and constantly hook them and rehook them, because if you're right, if you're sat in prime time, you're up against heavy competition. And if you're sat in prime time on a commercial channel where there's ad breaks, you are going to lose that's when you lose people, because they'll go, I don't know, we sold stuff. Let's see what's on BBC One where there's no adverts. And if they, you know, if there's something more interesting going on, that you won't get them back. So you have to be really good at kind of sneaky narrative devices to hook in a reader or a viewer in that case and keep them. When I was working in television, I went to one of these kind of strange how to make better telly things where someone had done some market research where they'd studied the viewing habits of people and said that on average the instinct to reach for the remote and see what else was on kicked in roughly every 2 minutes. So every 2 minutes, and you know, I mean, that, I bet it's less now. I bet it's like more like 20 seconds. People are going, yeah, I'm bored of this. What's next? And so what you have to do is you learn techniques of pacing, really, and structure. You know, you structure it properly so that you have a big proposition at the beginning that's intriguing enough to make you want to kind of like get through the first bit that develops it. Then you pose a big question, particularly if you're doing ad breaks, you pose a big question that then gets answered. You know, you want to know the answer of that. And it's constantly, you know, question and answer, learning more things. And so that at the end of it, you have a resolution and you have a kind of broader knowledge of the whole thing. You see the whole picture at the end that has been gradually, revealed to you. And all of those techniques are, I could have just described what you have to do as a thriller writer, because rather than just kind of engaging you and not reaching for the remote, you want them to turn the page. And now, if, you know, as people are reading them on e-readers or, you know, on multimedia devices, if your book's a bit boring, they will then go and watch an episode of True Detective instead, or they'll go on the internet, or they'll go and, you know, yeah, look on Facebook or whatever. So you're competing with all of that. And so, you know, you do have to, they're similar techniques, I think. And it's a good discipline. It's a really good discipline to sort of like constantly have to kind of construct those narratives and keep them fresh and interesting and make the surprises surprising, because, you know, people are very sophisticated in their reading and viewing habits and they can spot a twist coming a mile away. So you have to second and third guess them. In order to make it fresh. And so so it's good discipline, I think. And so I think, you know, people who come from any kind of, from TV or film, those narrative techniques of pacing and engaging the reader or the viewer are very, very similar.
Yeah.
And also there's the discipline, of course. There is the discipline of having to do it professionally, as in you turn up and be creative on demand. You know, there's that brilliant H.L. Mencken thing saying, you know, I only write when I'm inspired, but I see to it that I'm inspired at 9 o'clock every Monday morning. And, you know, and that's true. It's, you know, there's this kind of notions of writers sort of sitting in cafes and staring at the middle distance, and then some godlight hits them and then they write in a fugue until the morning, and then there it's done. And it's just, sadly, it's not like that, is it?
It's not.
Alone in rooms and grinding it out and just writing, you know, professional writer. If you're a professional writer, you write when you don't want to write, you know, which is often, because there's loads of other things to do. And it takes months to write a book, years to write a book. And it's like, it's not right. It's not right to be on your own in a room for that amount of time in your head. It's weird. It's a definition of insanity, isn't it? Sitting in a room on your own, listening to the voices.
Making up worlds. Yeah, but it's fun. Now,
oh, no, it's amazing. It's great. And I don't want to be disingenuous or anything like that, but but if you're professional, you have to do it. And then you produce a book and you have to produce another book in a year or less. And, you know, there's a discipline. And so that, I think, coming from something as fast moving as television is a really good apprenticeship, I think.
Mm. Yeah, and it's but of course you, as I said, quit your job, went and wrote this start of the book, finished the book whilst working. But this, your first book, right, became this massive global bestseller, and most people don't manage that with their first book. So do you? And I mean, having read them all, I think they're, you know, great books, so they well deserve that success. But do you think that that comes from the screenwriting side, or do you have any other tips for writing a worldwide bestseller?
Well, working for 20 years in television was a pretty good apprenticeship. And the thing is, you know, I don't have any unfinished books or multiple rejected books in my desk drawer. This is genuinely the first book I wrote, which I know sounds like sort of, yeah, I just wrote a book and it's a bestseller. But it was built on 20 years of, you know, writing kind of fairly terrible scripts and then writing better scripts and, you know, and then writing bigger programs and producing things. And so the rigor and the discipline of that, you know, they all of the series I made and all of the narratives that I have been involved in creating and structuring were my first novels, I think. Mm. And even though the writing is different, you know, like I said, about description and stuff like that, and, you know, and the pacing is different because the rhythm's in the words rather than in the cutting. I think that just comes from reading. You know, if you want to be a good writer, it's really simple. You read a lot. It's as simple as that. You cannot be a good writer unless you read widely and extensively and often. Because if you haven't written a book, it shows you how to write a book, because it's all there in front of you, and how narrative works and everything. And if you are writing a book, it shows you where the bar is. You read people who make you cross because you're like, oh, man, I wish I'd written that. Or that's so good. You know, and I'm constantly reading stuff that just sort of makes me sick because I'm like, oh my God, that's just like, that's such a great idea or a great character or a great turn of phrase or a brilliant bit of description. You know, there's always, you know, something. And if I read a book that's not good, I don't read it anymore. I stop reading it. There's too many good books.
Exactly.
You know, I'll give it a fair crack. But if it's not, if it hasn't grabbed me, then there's too many errors in it of whatever it is that's, you know, if I'm starting to look at the, if I can see the joins, if I can start seeing the, you know, the manipulation, the strings being pulled, then I just, and I'm a tough reader, I suppose, because, you know, I do it. You know, if you make a table, you can look at someone else's table and see why it's rickety.
Yeah.
So that's it. I mean, that's the key, I would say. And you know, it's and if you want to write a bestseller as well, read bestsellers. You know, don't just read books that you'd quite like to read. And by bestsellers, I'm, you know, books that were written and came out on bestsellers at the time, not slow burners that didn't do very well, and, you know, like Confederacy of Dunces or something that was stuck in a drawer, or that, you know, because you're not going to write Confederacy of Dunces. Don't go there. You know. But those things, you know, there is a very good reason why most books are bestsellers, and it's because they have a strong universal appeal. And it might be not apparent what that appeal is with a book like something, I don't know, like Curious Incident, The Dog in the Nighttime, or something like that. And you're like, it's a book about a kid with Asperger's, right? Okay, that doesn't sound very, you know. But it's like, but there is something in there. When you read it, it's something very human and very real and very true and beautifully done and all that kind of stuff. And so, of course, that's universal. So I just read the ones that kind of strike a chord and think about what it is about them. And I think because a lot of writers think that you write the best book you can, and then somehow it's in the lap of the gods. And in actual fact, it is to a degree. There's always a lot, you know, I've been very lucky. I've had a huge amount of luck as well. You have to have a lot, you know, a load of luck. But you also make your own luck to a degree by putting yourself in the right position and kind of thinking about something that you want to read. And also that's the thing. It's like, if you haven't, and a lot of the time with me, if I want to read it, it's because I haven't seen it before. Because I haven't read it anywhere else, and I'm thinking, and I get excited by the idea because I think, oh, this is new territory, or this is a different take on something, or I'm excited about where this could go as a writer and also as a reader. It's like, you know, you just, and I have commercial sensibilities because of working for 20 years in commercial television. You know, that's I'm finely tuned to those commercial things. But the thing is, it's sort of, you know, ultimately, my tip for writing a bestseller would be just like read lots of bestsellers and just, you know, marinate yourself in the way they work, because they are generally very, very kind of well-honed machines of narrative.
Yeah, no.
They do a very specific job.
Yeah. Now, last question. I was just reviewing the books and I discovered, to my horror, that I didn't have Sanctus anymore because it came out before the Kindle, which was, so I had it in print back in 2011 in Australia.
There you go then.
There was no Kindle.
I
have the other two on my Kindle, but not the first one. So I was just like, that's crazy, that because I remembered the first book very well. And so what do you think is, you know, obviously, so you started in this kind of publishing thing and you got the big deal in, but the publishing arena has really changed a lot. And a lot of my audience are indie authors, you know, running their own author businesses. What do you think about the changes in publishing, and have you seen anything of it, or are you kind of insulated, I guess?
Well, I know I'm very much interested in it and kind of watching the changes, and I'm aware, just looking at my own sales over the trilogy, how it's shifting in different territories. So my books sell very well on Kindle, I think partly because they're very fast paced and they're short chapters as well. All the books are multiple perspective. And again, I think that comes from sort of my film TV background, because, you know, you have a short scene and then you cut to another scene, and part of the pace comes from the structure, and the suspense comes from the structure of different points of view. So as a reader, you have a kind of better idea than any of the individual characters. And so you can be fearful for someone who doesn't know something that you know, and all that sort of stuff. And so they work really well on Kindle. And I've definitely seen my sales sort of, you know, slide more towards ebooks and more people buying them on ebooks. And they've certainly got a longer shelf life on ebooks. You know, the trilogy is still, I think, in the top 20 of the Kindle conspiracy thriller chart. And has been, I'm pretty much permanently, I think. It's sort of, you know, they dot around, but they come in. And I think the thing is again, ultimately, it's like, if you're self-publishing, I mean, obviously, if you're self-publishing, there are a whole bunch of other hats you need to wear of marketing and publicity. But as a so-called legacy author, you know, with a big publishing house behind me, I still have to do all of that. You know, there's still a huge amount of pressure on having a big social media presence and interacting with your readers and doing that. And I enjoy it. I totally get it, because I have to do all of that for television. You know, I understand that you make the program, but then you have to get people aware of it, otherwise no one will watch it. And it's the same. And I think the old days where you'd have a writer who delivered their book and then went away and sort of, you know, sat under a tree and relaxed and went around the world and then wrote their next book and whatever, are gone. You know, to be a professional author now, it's not a great deal of difference, I don't think. I mean, the things you have to do are the same, whether you've got one of the big publishers behind you or whether you're doing it yourself. Ultimately, and this is the given, is it's got to be a good book. You know, there's got to be something about it, and you have to do it professionally. If you're self-publishing, you still need to get it edited. You still need to get someone who you trust to read it and tell you what is wrong with it. Don't go, oh, it's great. Don't show it to your mum, who's going to tell you it's brilliant and you're amazing. You want to show it to someone who's maybe got an axe to grind a bit and is going to say, actually, this character sucks and I don't care about them. Your central characters annoy it. You know, that's what you need, because you need to put, you know, you build a tower and you want to push it and see if it falls down or bits fall off it. And if they do, you shore it up, you make it stronger. And, you know, I'm going through a big second draft now. It's not as if just because I'm, you know, under the lovely umbrella of HarperCollins that somehow, you know, there's a whole team of people who do that for me. It's like, ultimately, I have to do it all. It's my story. It's my thing. I mean, I have a brilliant set of people who I've worked with now on coming up to four books, and editors and people I trust, but we still go through the whole thing of everything and, you know, testing it and asking the questions and writing it and rewriting it and making it as good as it can possibly be, being professional about it. And then when it goes out, I blog and I'm always on Facebook and Twitter, you know, and I love that. I use that as a break and talk to people. And because of ebooks, you know, people are discovering the books all over the world all the time. And so you get people who just discover it and, you know, have read it and love it and want to talk to you about it and what you're doing next. And I love that. It's great. It's a great, because I can't travel everywhere, because otherwise I'd never write another book, you know, but it's a brilliant way of that immediacy. So I can see it's changing. I think it's harder to get noticed. I think it's harder for new authors, because there's so much stuff out there and there's so much of it is free. And I think the trouble is, and it's funny, I saw this in television, is there was a proliferation of, when I started, there were four channels in the BBC, you know, in the UK. There's BBC One, BBC Two, ITV and Channel Four. And now there's hundreds, you know, yeah. There's cable, there's all this sort of stuff. There's Netflix and stuff. Time. There's, you know, all iPlayer, view on demand. People's viewing habits have totally changed. But what is really interesting is the quality stuff is still there. Mm. The top, there's lots more sort of lower grade stuff. Mm. There's a lot of mediocre stuff and there's a lot of terrible stuff. There's more of it. Mm. So there's more choice. So you have to kind of be a lot more, you have to curate your own tastes and you have to curate your own viewing a lot more. And I don't think that's any difference in reading, you know, and that's why, you know, I always used to finish a book. I start a book and I was committed and I would finish the book. And now, just like you, if I read a book and it's not doing it for me within 20 pages, 30 pages maybe.
I'm like a 3-pager.
Really, 3? No, I'll give it a go because sometimes it's a slow burner. I mean, you know, but it's if I look at a book and I've started and I put down and it feels like homework, yeah. It feels like I'm going back. It's like I'm not going to pick that book up.
Yeah,
and that's, you know, whether you're a legacy author or whether you're a self-published author or a hybrid, as I think most people ultimately will end up being, you have to go there and bang your drum for your thing. And if you're passionate about it, it's what you have to do. And it's hard work. I think it's harder for people starting off because you have got this noise, this stuff, and it's really hard to sort of go, actually, mine's different, but all you just, it's focus on the quality and other readers will come, I think, because they will find it. And because word travels and people have, I recommend books that I read because people ask me, you know, I've just finished your trilogy, what else do I read? And I will, you know, I recommend books. I recommend yours now. And I want someone to help me navigate through the waters. My agent said, when about the whole digital thing, said, basically what's happened is the slush pile has been digitized.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's true. Totally. And the thing is, and the reason, and people have this notion of gatekeepers and, oh, well, I, you know, it goes on a slush pile and no ever reads it and you never get picked. I got, my book was picked up from the slush pile, you know, and it was, and they do read them because they're passionate people and they want to find something good. Mm. But the trouble is the reason that, you know, the thing about the slush pile is the reason it doesn't get picked up is because most of it isn't very good. It's not, it's derivative, it's not unoriginal, it's badly written, it hasn't been edited, it's, you yeah. know, it's
bad,
it
books
needs
won't
tons
sell
of work. Bad books don't sell, and they don't, and people give them away for nothing, and then people fill their ebooks going, oh, all these free books. And actually, a lot of the time they buy them because they've got a nice cover. And what it tells you is that person's better at doing covers than they are about writing books. But that's the thing. So I think just focus on your craft. Read a lot, whoever you are, whether you're going to be self-published or whatever, read a lot. Make it as good as it possibly can be. Write the story that you want to read, and it will happen.
Fantastic. So where can people find you and your books online?
Well, I am on Facebook. I have, I'm Simon Toyne Author, I think. Yes, Simon Toyne Author. And I'm Simon Toyne Twitter, @ Simon Toyne, all one word, lowercase. And I've got a website, simontoyne.net, which is going to be overhauled recently, soon, for the new book. And you can buy my books anywhere, you know, sort of Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Worcestons, anywhere. And HarperCollins, I think they've got their own thing now, so you can buy it direct from them, I believe, now. It's the future.
Thanks so much for your time, Simon. That was great.
No, thank you. It was a pleasure. Nice talking to you.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free Author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me @ The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook @ The Creative Pen. See you next time.